Lady Barclay, Reel 2. So did the German Air Force manage to put Bordsey out of action whilst you were there?
I don't remember them going particularly out of action, no. I mean, I think when that landmine dropped on the marshes, we were off the air for a short time, but not completely. It was a disaster. Quite soon they got us back on the air again.
And then I think there was a question of your being commissioned.
Yes. Then I was called up to see the CO. And I thought, oh, Lord, I must have done something wrong, because we always think you've done something wrong. And when I came in, he said, you've been recommended for a commission. And so I said, are you sure? That's right, you've got the right girl. He said, yes, I've been recommended for a commission. And so I had to go out. There were three of us all together, June and another girl and myself. And we had to go up to a board in Air Ministry or somewhere like that. I forget where it was now.
Did you want to be commissioned?
I hadn't thought about it. And so then I thought, well, I suppose it's quite a good idea. Would be, it's promotion, isn't it? And make perhaps be a bit interesting. And it was quite a new thing. You see, there hadn't been any commissioned radio ops. They were just starting then, and just one or two were going on these courses. So I thought, oh, I'm sure I shall never pass or anything. Anyway, I did pass. And then we were sent to, in January of 1942, I think it was, wasn't it? Yes, 42. We were then sent to Swanage, to Worth McTravers, TRE. And we started then to have these lectures. And, of course, they were incredibly technical from our point of view. I mean, I'll just show you here the sort of thing. I've got all these books.
These are your notebooks?
These are all my notebooks, you see, this sort of thing that we had to learn, you see. All these sort of things.
So a lot of it was trigonometry.
And you see, you, being a math teacher, you would understand all this. But, of course, we didn't because we hadn't done much trigonometry, and we were lectured to by a chap called Huxley, one of those Huxleys, and he said to us, well, I'm not going to put any formula or anything on the blackboard because I don't think you'll understand it. And then he turned to the blackboard and covered it with formula, and we all looked at it at each other like that, and we just didn't understand any of it, really. We tried to understand it, and so we thought, well, we better take it all down, and then we would, study it later and try and get it in our heads. But we went along at such a pace. I mean, if you could see all these books, you see, they're just...
So you faithfully got it all down.
Yes, we got it all.
Hoping to understand it later.
That's right, and then June and I, we used to go and study it all in the evening. Our heads were aching. But mind you, I was very interested in it all because, you see, as I told you before, I did like maths. It was the thing that I enjoyed. And so if I'd had time to sort of learn more about it, it would have been easier. But, of course, the people who would understand was those who had a maths degree. And you can imagine how difficult it was for us to try and understand the theory of all this radar. Well, anyway, then we did, all the various things that we went on. And then one of the things, we went to Stanmore. And when I was in the filter room there, it just happened to be the afternoon of the Scharnhorst, when I saw this Scharnhorst on the table. You see, and that was the most extraordinary thing. I went into the filter room, and there was a complete hush. There wasn't a sound. You see, normally it was all busy, all the plots coming in from all the stations. Heat hush, and someone said to me, look down on the table, there was a round plaque there, and then said, that's thought to be the Scharnhorst. And all the radar stations were jammed with interference from the Germans, with FMCW. That was a sort of type of jamming.
FMCW,
frequency modulated CW, it was. And that made the tube go rumpf. Like that, and you couldn't really pass any plots. And after they said that no one knows whether it really is the Scharnhorst or not, and then after a time, suddenly it was decided it was the Scharnhorst, and they sent out all these swordfish. I don't know how many went out, but I think... Now, where is all... I really should have had these notes, you see, because I've...
Don't worry about the numbers, because that's on the record in
oh,
the
it
histories.
Is.
Yes.
And hardly any came back. I think something like 60 were shot down, something like that. It was quite terrible. And we thought of all those pilots, you know, who went out like that. And we felt, in a way, it was the fault of the people at Filter Room, the controller there, that he didn't realize it was a Scharnhorst, and the Gneisenau as well. And before that, the radar stations had been plotting the fighter cover over the Scharnhorst at, was it Brest it was at, or somewhere like that.
Yes.
And they'd been passing all this, and no one would believe it at Filter Room. They wouldn't believe that it was the cover. And then, of course, all the interference started, and then nobody could pass any plots at all. So it went up the channel like that. Practically with the aircraft circling overhead, I suppose, not plotted. Something like that, anyway. But it was a very strange scene in the filter room there, and I just happened to be there. I was very lucky to see that.
You were just a visitor or someone
well,
learning the job?
Yes, that's right. We were taken there, you see, as part of our commission course. We visited all these places. I've got it written down here. Yes, the Stanmore, that's right. Of course, at the filter room, that's right.
This incident you've been describing is the famous channel breakout of February 1942, when they broke out from
February
the channel.
February the 12th, that's right. That's what it was. And we'd all been waiting for that, you know, and watching for it. And when it happened, then the South Coast was jammed. That was the trouble. The German jamming of the CH stations so that the fighter cover couldn't be plotted. And there was just this plaque on the filter room table, sort of in the middle, and which was thought to be the Scharnhorst. I think it was possibly the CHL stations, which were for the low-flying aircraft, that had picked it up. But the CH stations weren't passing any plots at all.
Which other places did you visit during that period of instruction in February 42?
Well, then we went here to... we went to Dunkirk, visited there. And then we went to Biggin Hill, we went to Pevensey. And then back to Dunkirk again, where we had our final board. And... that was quite extraordinary, because I always had boyfriends all over the place. And on that particular course, I'd met one who was a technical officer. And I was picking his brains and asking him a few things. And the night before my board, I said to him I was quite interested in a thing called attenuation in the feeder lines, the effect on the station if you had attenuation in the feeder lines. So I asked him to explain this to me. And we hadn't really been taught very much about it. And so he explained it all to me, and I had it then really right in my head at that time. And so when I went before the board, I just thought to myself, I just willing them to ask me this question, what would the effect be on the station's performance if you had attenuation in the feeder lines? So I walked in and saluted. There was a board of about four people there behind a desk, sat down. And they looked at me and they said, the first question they said is, what would be the effect on the station if you had attenuation in the feeder lines? It was unbelievable. So out came my answer, absolutely pat like that. And they all looked at each other like this, you see. They thought, wow. Funny how this girl knows all this, you see, because I'm sure they were, you know, asking me something. We hadn't really been very well taught, because we went so quickly through it. And they didn't answer. So then I said to them, what do you think? And they all started, you know, talking between themselves and wondering what it would be. And they never asked me a single other question and just said, right. And I went out and I passed. But you see, that's why I say I ought not to have passed, because it was really cheating in a way, because hardly anybody passed that course. And my poor friend, who failed, she knew far more than I did. And they asked her, she failed because they asked her a sort of trick question too, which I remember, which was, we had a thing called a VPD, which is a vertical polar diagram. That is from the station. Each station has a lobe like that of sensitivity due to direct rays and indirect rays coming from the ground. And they said, the point of this, would you think that came from the base of the tower or the top of the tower? Now, that's an incredibly extraordinary question to ask, because it couldn't possibly matter where it came from. And she was absolutely flummoxed. And she couldn't answer the question, because we'd never been told such a thing. And she was terribly upset. She just cried and cried and cried, because she was so upset to what her mother would think, because she hadn't passed. But in actual fact, it was much better not to pass, because then she went on the same course all over again and got her knowledge more consolidated, whereas I, who had passed, felt very unsure of myself because I didn't know all this stuff sufficiently, as you can imagine, because it was all, you know, much more technical than one had been used to. And another thing with me too, I hadn't been an NCO. And that was a big disadvantage to me. I went straight from being an LACW to being commissioned.
Why would it have been much better if you had been an NCO?
Well, because if you've been an NCO, you've then been in charge of a watch. And I never had been in charge of a watch. See, I'd just been a member of a watch. And so then when one was posted to one's first station, it was very frightening to be in charge of NCOs and everything, who probably had more experience than I'd had on a watch. And then there was this thing, the calculator that we had by then, which instead of having, you know, doing the plots manually with this ruler and everything, you just then press two buttons and it was all done by a calculator, which was housed in, and there's a huge great room, it seemed to me about the size of this room, with cams that used to go whizzing round like that. And if it went wrong, an awful bell went and a red light, and the person in charge of the watch had to go and deal with that, sort of trace things along and pull out little pegs, you know, where the thing had gone wrong. Well, of course, as I'd never been in charge of a watch, and we were never taught that sort of thing on the course, I was terrified that this thing should ever go wrong. And I would then have to go and deal with it when I didn't know how to deal with it. You can imagine how frightening that was, can't you?
Did it go wrong?
Well, it didn't up at Rowan Hill, no. Hill Head, where I went, fortunately, no, it didn't. But it was always in my mind. I was terrified that it might go wrong. But the thing that really frightened me when I got to my first station was we then had to start giving lectures on this work that we'd learned, when, for me, you see, I felt I didn't know it well enough myself. And certain aspects of it, like finding height finding and a thing called the height curve, that was something we needed to know about, and I did know about that, and I didn't find that at all difficult, and I loved all that aspect of it. But when it came to, you know, talking about the workings of the goniometer and things like that, you know, it really was quite alarming. And there was just so much to tell the operators. And I just didn't feel I knew it all sufficiently well myself. And that I did find very frightening. As well as that, I found the night watches terribly, terribly tiring. I was always tired. Tired, tired, tired. Never seemed to have enough sleep. And the work, of course, was very exacting, really, having to watch this tube. It's like a cathode ray tube sort of thing.
So this was at Hill Head. In the Glasgow area, is it? In Scotland?
No, it's up in Aberdeenshire.
North East Scotland.
Yes.
From April to September 42.
That was my first station as a supervisor, we were called.
But did anything go radically wrong whilst you were
there,
supervisor?
You mean technically? No, not really. No.
So,
and that was a nice, you know, I loved that station really. And I was just always tired up there. Yes, one was always longing for fresh air because the blocks that we worked in, you see, were very, very stuffy. And a lot of them tend to be a bit underground and they were very badly ventilated. And so one was always longing to go and breathe fresh air and be out in the sun a bit. And so I used to get on my bicycle and ride away like that and down to the sea and sit by the sea, and it was just lovely to do that. And then my friend June, who by now had passed her course, and I was longing for her to be up on this, at the same station with me, and we arranged. She was coming, and so she came, and when she arrived, she had a dog with her called Genghis. And I said to her, may she bring a dog with her? I said, yes, that's all right, bring the dog. And when she arrived with Genghis, she didn't realize that Genghis was pregnant. And in no time at all, she produced 11 puppies. So the CEO was rather shocked. And he said, I gave permission for one dog, not 12. So the puppies, I think, were very popular, and eventually they were all given away to various people. Well, then, quite soon after that, I developed in my neck some rather painful lumps. And I had to go to the doctor. And when he looked at these lumps, he said, oh, I think, you know, you might have to have these cut out. And the idea of that may be I fainted straight off. And then eventually I was sent down to group headquarters, to the medical officer there to have an examination to see if I had TB. And I think I had contracted some sort of TB, possibly when I was at Bawdsey, because I'd been drinking their milk, which probably hadn't been pasteurized or something, and then also perhaps the stuffiness of the block. So there was a bit of a panic when they thought that one of the WAFs had got TB. And it was discovered that all these lumps were calcified, and that was okay. So then I started after that. My life became much more interesting after I got to 60 Group, which was down at Leighton Buzzard.
Whilst you were doing these jobs as station supervisor, did any disciplinary aspects come into the work? Did you have disciplinary control over the people under you?
Not really, because there was an admin officer who did that. She did discipline. We were purely the operational side. We were in charge of the operations of the station, and we had to organize all the watch systems, the watch lists, write a technical report, which we sent into Wing every month, I think it was, of the activities of the station. And then we had to supervise the passing of the LAs for the LACWs for the exams, you know, and sometimes set exams for the ACWs, the WAFs, you know, who are working on the set. And the discipline came under the admin. We didn't have anything of that. In any case, you know, there wasn't much discipline anyway because everybody was working so hard. And just we really put in long hours. We were all very tired. Everybody was tired. And we were all just with our eye on the job, really.
So in October 42, you went to RAF Canewdon in Essex.
Yes, now that was very exciting because I was then at 60 Group and I was going to go to St. Lawrence, which was a station on the Isle of Wight, a new station that was being set up there. And until that was ready, I was sent to Canewdon supposedly for a week, but in actual fact I stayed a month. And this station was not quite on the air yet, although it was a station. It was one of the original stations, I think. but it was having all new equipment installed. And so the whole of the block was absolutely full of boffins. And I was there just in the middle of all these boffins, and I loved it because they were all doing new things and experimenting and calibrating and this and that. And I was just sort of there finding out and picking people's brains and really enjoying myself. And I stayed there a whole month. And I think I did quite a lot of tidying up as well as that sort of thing in the block. I don't really know quite what I did do, but all I know is I was having a very exciting time and there's a lot of work going on, and this is what I really liked, lots and lots of activity, compared with Hill Head, where there was nothing happening at all. It was a very boring station from the work point of view. So I loved Canewdon. And then I went back to 60 Group again, and I was then sent to St. Lawrence on the Isle of Wight. Now that was a very small little station right down on the water's edge, just west of Ventnor. And the idea of that station was that it was going to help Ventnor itself, which was right stationed, situated high up at the top of the downs there, and because of its situation it was unable to find heights very well. And so they needed another station that would be concentrating on height finding. Well, that was of great interest to me, was the height finding. And on that station, funnily enough, it was mainly men. There were only about three WAFs there, and these were all men who were on the watches, and they were mainly older men. And when I arrived there, age 21, they thought it was a great joke, this girl coming, and they used to sort of threw open the gate for me and say, ma'am, like that, you know, as I came rushing through on my bicycle. And they were all extremely polite and gentlemanly and really nice chaps. And I think I did quite a good job on that station because I got it to be very enthusiastic and very keen, because we were very proud of our stations. You know, we were rather sort of competing with other stations all the time and thinking if we had good plots and good heights, we felt very pleased with ourselves. And on that station at that time, what we were mostly doing was plotting out bombers which went out into the area of Caen, and softening up all that ready for the invasion. Of course, we didn't know that the invasion was going to take place there. We thought it was going to take place in the Pas-de-Calais area. We all thought that. Everybody seemed to think that. But there was all this, every night, bombers going out, bombers, bombers, bombers. So it was quite a busy station, mainly night activity. And again, we were just two of us on then. And I used to go and do night watches and then come off night watch at about 3 a.m. And that was very frightening because I had to walk. The station was sort of in a field where there were cows, and I had to walk back in the dark on my own through this field of cows and then up through a sort of wooded lane and back. And I had my bicycle always, and I used to turn my coat collar up like this and turn my light out because I was so frightened that I might be attacked in the dark, just all alone. And then when I got up to the top of the hill, I used to speed down back to the place where we stayed, which was Rocklands, which was a Victorian house that had been taken over, and we were billeted there. And again, it's just recently been taken over, so it was rather sparse and spare and not very well furnished, but we sort of started getting it going. And there was a very nice WAF officer there, Mrs. Taylor, who took me under her wing, and she was just like a mother to me. And when I got back, she always waited up for me till 3 a.m, which I think was quite fantastic of her to do a thing like that, because she knew I was frightened, and she really looked after me.
And how much need was there during the war to fear about the law and order situation?
Oh, well, there wasn't really much fear at all, but on the Isle of Wight there, there was a man, a local man, who had been in the army, and he was known to be not quite right. He was a bit, you know, disturbed in the head. And so he was just sort of lurking about there, and he started writing notes to me. I don't know how he found out about me, but I felt that he was watching me, And that's what made me so frightened about coming home, because I felt he might note that I was walking up there on my own quite regularly at 3 o'clock in the morning.
So it was apprehensions about a particular individual?
Yes, it was. I was quite apprehensive, quite frightened. When I think of it now, I feel quite frightened. And on the Isle of Wight, too, I was once followed at night by a soldier. And I just had to turn round and face him like that and say, "You're following me." And it's really horrible to be followed by men, but, you know, that's the lot of women, I'm afraid, particularly when you're young.
Did anything happen?
No, I just stood there and I said, "I'm not moving another yard till you go back to Ventnor," because I was walking home from Ventnor. And it was dark and I was having to go into the undercliff, which was, in those days, it's not like it now, because since the hurricane all these trees have gone, but it was all elm trees and great trees and sort of all dark and over like that. And I thought, well, if I go there and I'm being followed, anything can happen to me. So I just, before I actually got out of Ventnor, I turned and faced him and said, "You go back to Ventnor, I'm standing here till you've gone." And then I walked home, but I was very frightened.
Did he do what you told
yes,
him to?
Yes, he did. He did, because fortunately then I was an officer and he wasn't, so he took note because I was an officer, I suppose, and I sounded very fierce. Any rate, the sort of, we had quite a lot of fun there, because we used to go up onto the downs during the day and gather mushrooms and cook them on night watch. And then on that station I was entertainments officer. I wasn't much good at entertainments officer anyway. We then got up a play called Tilly of Bloomsbury, and everybody seemed to be in it. And then we were getting all the scenery done and everything else. And fortunately, just before the day arrived, half the cast were posted. So that was a big let out. I thought, oh, thank God for that. So the whole thing was off. That was the finish of that. And then we were quite near a place called the Old Park, which was where a German spy was meant to have been. And it was all, you couldn't get there because it was all mined and everything. It's now a hotel along there. And that was a very secret place. I longed to go there, but of course one couldn't go there because you couldn't get there.
What made you think there was a German spy there?
Well, that was the story. There had been a German spy in the First World War. Can you turn that off?